failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies. Welcome to this edition of Century of Lies. Today, we'll take another listen to the King County Bar Association's conference, The Exit Strategy from the War on Drugs. Once again, the panel moderator is Eric Sterling, president of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation, cjpf.org.
Our next presenter, Dr. Steven Ziegler.
I would start out by first by saying I conduct research on the barriers to the treatment of pain. In a related area of end-of-life decision-making, a very controversial area, particularly the topic of assisted suicide, and we'll see how in a moment why these two things are related. The title of my talk today is about the negative impact of drug policy, specifically on the treatment of pain. I'll begin by providing a little bit of a background and then close with some suggestions or some ideas, and possibly we could expand upon those in the breakout session on medical use and addiction later today. To begin with, pain is undertreated in the United States. Approximately 50 million Americans are suffering from chronic pain that's undertreated. And of those who are dying, 50% in this one particular study found that they suffered moderate to severe pain within 3 days of their death. Now, there are a variety of reasons why pain is undertreated. But one of the primary reasons certainly stems from the negative impact of drug policy, this drug war that we are waging, a war waging against our very own people. The patients and providers are certainly the victims of that particular war. For example, as far as patients are bombarded with erroneous information from the media and the government regarding the proper use of opioids. We hear constantly say no to drugs without qualification. We ask for a partnership for a drug-free America. They worry about becoming addicted and the particular side effects. Providers, healthcare providers, are also victims of the so-called drug war. They fear, for example, addicting their own patients, even though the iatrogenic addiction rate is extremely low. Moreover, particularly in my area of research, they fear criminal investigation and prosecution from a variety of agencies, specifically for pharmaceutical diversion. They fear local, state, and federal law enforcement authorities, and they fear their own medical boards, those same regulators who many of them are unaware of the positive role of opioids in the treatment of pain. In fact, there was a study in 1984 by Ziegler et al., is that once a triplicate prescription program was implemented in Texas, shortly thereafter, opioid prescriptions dropped by 60%. Quite a significant impact. As a result of this war, both patients suffer and physicians under Medicaid. Now, we know that the primary reliance on the criminal justice system to deter or prevent drug abuse, prevent crime, improve public health is ineffective as a treatment and certainly costly. Not only is this treatment ineffective, it has negative side effects in terms of race, civil liberties, and here, the treatment of pain. And in fact, this treatment of pain and drug policy has spilled into the physician-assisted suicide debate. Physicians fear that if they aggressively treat the pain of their dying patients, that they may be accused of hastening their patient's death should the patient expire during the course of palliative care. Moreover, as a result of a particular conservative population who has sought to outlaw and override the will of the Oregon voters, they've sought to outlaw physician-assisted suicide in Oregon through the use of the Lethal Drug Abuse Prevention Act in 1998, the Pain Relief Promotion Act of 1999, none of which had anything to do with pain, but more had to do with eliminating assisted suicide of what the polity in Oregon had decided that they wanted. Unfortunately, of course, physicians worried again that they may themselves lose their ability to prescribe or become prosecuted, and of course, as a result, under-medicated. In fact, the case before the United States Supreme Court, Oregon v. Ashcroft, now Gonzalez, is another example of that movement of trying to eradicate assisted suicide at the expense of pain relief. Now, having provided that background, what perhaps are some suggestions for reforms or ideas? This is a complicated issue, not something susceptible to an 8-second soundbite or slogan, except perhaps that the current system or treatment is not working. There is certainly, in these recommendations of these ideas, there's some overlap between law enforcement and state licensing board, but they, of course, are interrelated. To begin with, we should, I think, take a bottom-up approach as opposed to some legislature imposing a particular law like intractable pain treatment acts. Committed professionals can and make a difference. Now, in terms of working with the current system, involve the stakeholders, the law enforcement community, the regulatory authority, the pain treatment community. Number two, educate those stakeholders and the public on the negative impact of drug policy on patients and the need for balance. Balance, balance, balance. And that is that we certainly, for whatever reason, whatever model we use, need to regulate, apparently, prescription drugs, but that regulation should not come at the expense of patients suffering in pain, of course, which it does. Further education is through continuing medical education requirements, as well as perhaps medical school curriculum. This should be an ongoing effort, not simply something to done on one occasion. Third, work with the state medical boards in regards to their policies, the physician medical boards, nursing, pharmacy. Establish a frequently asked questions. Now, the Drug Enforcement Administration recently redacted that from their website, and that was controversial as it is. Well, the easy thing is just adopt that form of frequently asked questions, because the policy community, pain policy community, and regulators have done a terrific amount of work, so it would require very little revision. Two, along those lines with the medical boards, is to revise those guidelines. And I would argue for the adoption of the federal state medical board model guidelines for the treatment of pain. Many states have, in fact, adopted these in its entirety. And if Washington, I know, has not, then the question needs to become, why not? So an additional idea is perhaps because physicians face scrutiny from local, federal, state, and law enforcement, as well as a variety of other agencies, perhaps educate that state medical board, many of which are not educated as far as the positive role of opioids, but educate those medical board regulators and make them a clearinghouse, is that before a physician is investigated by any of these agencies, what about contacting a well-informed medical board? And that type of clearinghouse, that type of coordination, I think could advance the profession and certainly the treatment of pain as well. And finally, another recommendation is to reach out to other jurisdictions and agencies that have had a positive result. This is an experiment, and at times there's going to be mistakes, and so we need to learn from our mistakes as well as learn from the other positive things of other agencies and jurisdictions. And certainly one fantastic agency is the Pain and Policy Studies Group at the University of Wisconsin, with Dr. Aaron Gilson and David Jorson, senior scientists there. They work extremely well and do some excellent work, and I think would be a fantastic resource. And further, for example, the Attorney General of Oklahoma, Ed Munson, is on board with 29 other states protesting the redaction of the frequently asked questions that was formally posted and approved by the Drug Enforcement Administration. I will close with a quote from, in fact, a licensing board in Utah, which states that the unnecessary and unwise intrusion into the doctor-patient relationship by the regulator is the classic representation of abusive government acting at its worst. Positive change can happen. Thank you.
You are listening to Century of Lies on the Drug Truth Network, and that was Dr. Stephen Ziegler speaking at the King County Bar Association's Exit Strategy from the War on Drugs Conference. And this is Eric Sterling, the panel moderator.
As we think about the relief of pain, that's probably the paradigm of the concept that the proper use of drugs is a blessing. The proper use of drugs is a blessing, of course, in relief of pain and cancer chemotherapy. But we have to also understand that in the recreational sense, in the spiritual sense, the proper use of drugs is a blessing. And that there is, we should not sort of see simply the traditional medical practice as the outer boundary of what the blessings are that we can get from the use of drugs. And this is, in some respect, a testimony to how deeply ingrained the fear of DEA is. Our final speaker is a woman who has never been afraid of the powerful institutions in our society. Deborah Small is an attorney and advocate from New York who I have had the pleasure of hearing advocate before legislative bodies and other organizations. She is one of the most clear voices that I know in our movement, and I'm honored to be able to introduce her to you this morning, Deborah Peterson Small.
I want to start out actually by referring back to what Sanho said when he first started talking about the drug war as being a war on plants that do not respond to political dictates or legislative dictates. And I say that that's true, at least rhetorically. But I think in reality it's important for us to understand that the drug war is, in fact, you know, a case of what war always is, which is the employment of force and violence against certain communities and certain people and their institutions in order to attain certain political objectives. I don't think that it's an accident who or coincidence which of the people are targeted, not just in the U.S., but internationally for the focus of drug war, drug law enforcement. And I think it's an important thing for us to continue to remember as we talk about these issues and talk about what it means to have an exit strategy from the war on drugs. So, you know, I don't think that I have to tell you all about the fact that race has been an important factor in who has been the targets of the drug war and the way in which our military style attack and police control has affected the culture and institutions of poor communities of color. So what I thought I would do is sort of briefly go through some of the major issues regarding the racial disparities of the drug war, but then talk really more about some of the issues about what does it mean to have a primarily libertarian approach to addressing the issue of drug policy reform, and what are the responses of communities of color and other poor affected communities to that approach to addressing drug policy reform. So for me, the major issues with respect to racial disparity boil down to a few that many of us are familiar with. First of all, you have the problem of disparate policing, the targeting of communities based on racial stereotypes and misperceptions. I felt that the study that was done here in Seattle by the Defenders Association was a landmark and wonderful study to really show the ways in which the disparate policing of communities is really driven by stereotypes and not by the conventional thinking that we have that it has to do with where the outdoor markets are, where the violence is, where the money is, etc. No, as Seattle showed, a lot of it is driven by the belief that people have about which drugs are the most dangerous, regardless of how that relates to fact, and which are the people who are using it. And I think it's important for us to think about that, because I have to say that as we have conversations about the drug trade, there are assumptions that we continue to make, even amongst ourselves, that fly in the face of what we all know is true about the drug war, which is that the majority of drug users and the majority of drug sellers are white people, and they're not poor people, and they're not people who live in depressed communities. But as long as we keep talking about the drug economy as if it's limited to those communities, then it leaves us, you know, ignoring a huge segment of the drug economy and a huge segment of people who benefit from the current system that we have in place. One of the other issues around racial disparity is the administration of justice. You know, it's amazing to me the fact that we have allowed for almost two or three generations now the disparate type of administration of justice in this country without a major public outcry. And I'm not just talking about an outcry about the disproportionate numbers of people of color who end up behind bars, but the fact that at every single stage of the system, we have outcomes that favor at the expense of people of color. And yet, if we were talking about anything other than drugs, people would be very clear that there was something wrong about this. You know, if we were talking about people's sexual behavior, if we were prosecuting, you know, fornication and adultery, and the only people who ended up getting prosecuted for it were dark-skinned people, folks would say, wait a minute. You know, we know that there are plenty of white people, plenty of affluent people who are breaking those laws. It is clearly unjust if this is the result that you have. But somehow, when it comes to drugs, we've been willing to put blinders on to the reality of what we know is so, and to actually create a system where we have, from my point of view, a get-out-of-jail card free for anyone who has the money and the ability to be able to play it. And it allows us to maintain the hypocrisy that we're really fighting a war on drugs, when in fact we're just fighting a war on poor people and vulnerable people. So I'm not, you know, going to go into talking about the whole issue of the crack cocaine sentencing disparity or the outrageous amount of sentences people get, or the fact that once you've been convicted of a drug offense, you're permanently stigmatized and ostracized from society. I mean, it's almost, when you think about the litany of horrors associated with our drug policy, you really have to wonder, you know, what is the rationale that's driving it? Because it clearly doesn't make sense if, in fact, you were about rehabilitating people and creating a healthy society to say to someone that once you've gone to prison, done your time, and tried to maintain sobriety, that we're going to keep you from having access to housing, to any kind of income support, to education, to most civil service jobs, to most low-paying private sector jobs that would enable you to do the things that we say that we want you to do, which is to stay clean and be law-abiding. And so for me, even the current focus around reentry that and the bandwagon that everybody's on around that is completely hypocritical, because it's not attached to policy change that would have us remove the legislative barriers that we've put in place that make it possible for people to reenter society in a positive way. It's one more aspect of I see the hypocrisy of our drug war policies, the fact that the way in which we wage the drug war only increases the amount of crime and violence and dislocation in the very communities that we say we're trying to benefit by engaging in the policies that we do. And as a result of that, we've had some significant health impacts and political impacts on vulnerable communities. But from my point of view, the more important thing for us to think about is not all of the ways in which we know that the drug war disproportionately affects racial minorities and poor people, but to think about what are the barriers within those communities and within our thinking about being able to promote a drug policy reform agenda. Well, first and foremost, you know, people of color are no different from everyone else in terms of believing that drugs are bad. And in fact, there's a very strong belief among most minority communities that drugs are bad. And this is reflected, in fact, by the lower level of drug use among blacks and Hispanics and the generally conservative attitude in those communities towards drugs, sex, and alcohol use. And the fact that the immorality of using drugs is reinforced by the church in a community where the level of religious participation is fairly high. So I think that that's something that's important for us to keep in mind. The fact that the use of drugs has been habitually, even within communities of color, associated with the lower classes. That the ghettoization of the drug problem has led to, quite frankly, some class interest in maintaining the focus there. If you pretend that it's primarily these people in the projects, in the ghetto communities who have the problem, then you can continue to ignore the degree in which it exists in your own house, in your own community. And it may not be manifesting itself in the use of cocaine or methamphetamines, but it may be reflected in the number of martinis that are drank every day, whether or not the person has an attachment to Paxil, Xanax, or any of the other drugs that we're using every day to deal with the same types of stress that people use illicit drugs for. And to believe that there isn't a class aspect to the way in which this plays out is to ignore the reality of why it is that the majority of Americans who are affluent tend to support our drug war policies, and the fact that the people who are poor also support them, because they believe that It's one of the ways in which you ensure your upward mobility is by separating yourself from the bad elements in your community. One of the prices that every immigrant community has paid, regardless of their color, in their movement up the economic ladder, is by, to a large degree, separating themselves from those people who could be defined as criminals, separating themselves from those people who can be defined as deviant, and attaching themselves to whatever are the prevailing norms of the majority society, and requiring that people adhere to that as a requirement for being part of the group. And then, you know, not the other part, in fact, is that I believe that there's a fear among a lot of people of color that if you had a system of regulation and control of drugs, that that would lead to more drug use among youth of color. And I think that that fear is not unwarranted, because there have been many studies that have shown that there's a lower level of drug use among youth of color that attend predominantly black colleges and universities than those who go to more integrated schools. And from a black perspective and a brown perspective, that reinforces the belief that associating with the majority community is not always a good thing if it leads you down the path to engage in activities that you've been taught at home not to do. And just as the issue of youth is at the core of drug policy reform within the majority community, it's at the core of the concerns about drug policy reform within communities of color. The fact that we have a strong belief in the notion of personal responsibility and willpower, the bootstrap mentality. I think it's really important for people to think about the fact that the right of consumption belief that's sort of inherent in the libertarian approach to drugs flies in the face of the communal traditions of communities of color. Our culture does not assert that what you do doesn't matter to the rest of your family, that what you ingest and the way that you behave is just about you, and that you get to determine that by yourself. The communal traditions of most communities of color hold people accountable for what they do, that it's a reflection on the community as a whole, and that there's a willingness and a commitment to using whatever available behavioral modification tools are available to have people conform to what's considered to be the community norms. Now, I would say that what you see in black and brown communities is a backlash to the over-policing, the over-incarceration of people, but that doesn't mean that they're willing to take the leap to having no controls at all. And if you think about what the consequences of repealing alcohol prohibition has meant in poor communities, there's reasons for that fear. You know, I live on 123rd Street in Harlem, and I have to tell you that there's a hell of a lot more liquor stores in my neighborhood than there are health food stores. In fact, most poor people don't have the option of being able to eat healthily to maintain their body integrity, because that's outside of their economic range. Tobacco products are being advertised on every street corner in every billboard. You know, I and not too many people I know would advocate locking people up for using alcohol and tobacco, I have to acknowledge that there's a strong sense that the way in which we regulate those things have not worked particularly well for communities of color, because they're being done inside the capitalist framework that says that the most important thing is to make a dollar. And if you can make it by going after poorer people who are not as educated about their health and protection, then you do that. And my fear, and the fear of many others, is that if we don't have an approach to drug policy reform that takes into consideration these economic issues, if we don't understand the fact that we have used the drug war over the last 3 or 4 decades to actually take resources out of communities of color, what Cliff said is really true. You know, to say that we're going to liberalize the law and we're not going to do anything to fix what we've broken, or that we're not going to address the fact that we put the drug war in place as a substitute for dealing with the issues of poverty, then that to me is a bankrupt policy. And as a person who really cares, I really care about how we deal and address the issue of prohibition, because I believe that it's one of the worst social injustices of our society. But I have to tell you that it troubles me to think that we're engaged in this policy debate without attaching it to the broader social economic, political, and cultural problems in this society that must be addressed. So I would hope that as we go forward over the next 2 days, that we really think about that and that we look around the room and ask ourselves whether or not the people who are in here are the people who should be here and who else needs to be here. Thank you.
We will continue with more of the exit strategy from the war on drugs in the coming weeks. I want to thank Eric Sterling of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation for his help. I want to thank Dr. Steven Ziegler for pointing out the hypocrisy involved and how even our doctors are now being penalized, demonized by this drug war. And I want to thank Deborah Small for speaking out for communities of color. You know, I realize I can't speak for people of color. All I can do is speak to them. I want to remind the listeners that week in, week out, I try to bring you voices from the black and brown communities, people who have seen the harms of the drug war, people who have analyzed it and understand the mechanisms of the drug war, and who have determined better solutions for progress in this regard, who know that we must change our current drug war policy. As a third party, so to speak, who has not had much involvement with the black community, I can only assume that the churches and the medical community and even the scholars have failed you. On most Century of Lies programs, I close with a phrase that goes something like, there is no truth, justice, logic, scientific fact, medical data. There is no religious underpinnings. There is, in fact, no reason for the drug war to continue for even one more second. Beginning in the early 20th century, cocaine-crazed Negroes were said to be impervious to .32-caliber bullets, so they moved up to .38s. Chinese on opium were said to be a threat to the white population. Hispanics, under the spell of the devil's weed, would steal our women and our jobs. In any other aspect of life on this planet, results are the telling factor, are the reasons for continuing a given policy. And yet, for illegal drugs, they are now cheaper, purer, and more freely available to our children than ever before. This despite the expenditure of $11 trillion, that's with a T, handed over to the black market and to law enforcement. Each year we arrest 1.6 million nonviolent drug users for baggies of flowers or other plant extracts, the overwhelming majority of which are people of color. Currently, we have more than 1 million blacks behind prison bars. Currently, we have tens of millions of people whose lives have been shattered by the ramifications of a drug bust, who can no longer obtain government housing, food stamps, education, credit, or a job outside the black market. I started out doing this work, this Drug Truth Network, to benefit myself, I suppose, to my kids, and now my myriad of grandkids, and someday soon, I suppose, great-grandkids. But as I delved into this cesspool of hypocrisy, this war on drugs, it became more and more apparent that this is a racial policy, that this is a biased policy of hatred against certain people, people of color. But the truth be told, I want no part of this policy. Whatever legacy I can hand down to our children, I hope contains none of this hatred, which truly is the drug war. Each week I close with the phrase, Prohibido istac evilesco, which means prohibition is evil. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Duffy.